Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with James Lee Burke, whose new book is Cleat, a wonderful novel told from the point of view of Cajun detective Dave Robichaud's faithful sidekick, Cleat Purcell. We'll also hear from Kent Wascom, whose new book is The Wild and Woolly, Welcome to West Florida. James Lee Burke is a New York Times bestselling author and three-time winner of the Edgar Award, most recently, earlier this year, for his beautiful historical novel, Flags on the Bayou. He has written more than 40 novels and two standout short story collections. In his new novel, Cleat, Burke takes us into the mind of longtime Dave Robichaud's sidekick, Cleat Purcell. Along the way, we learn a lot about male friendship, their long history in war abroad and at home, and the way New Orleans and New Iberia have been part of their lives. It's a ready-made Louisiana classic. Jim's speaking to us this morning from his home in Montana. Welcome back, Jim.
Well, it's great to be on your program again.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you. Now, what fun and a little scary to see the world from Cleat's point of view. So what made you take on this shift in point of view? Have you been thinking about this for a while?
Well, other people were. They were trying to get me to do this for years, and I just finally decided it was time. And it's an experiment, so I hope people enjoy it.
Oh, they will. They will.
Yeah. I'm quite proud of it. And Cleat just comes through all beautifully. He's just a great character. I mean, he's just a really fond kind of fellow, and people are fond of him. And he represents what's best in us, I think.
And he's just larger than life. You can see him. You can see that pork pie hat and the shirt, everything. You can see the car, the Eldorado caddy. I mean, you went back to the late 90s for this story. So talk about making that choice and going back to that period in history.
Well, it's right before the towers, as he says. And and I just decided, Dave and Cleat are part of an earlier America. And the things that they are interested in are really have their origins in the Depression era and World War II, and then, of course, the Korean War. But all of those things actually have to do with neocolonialism. That's has always been the theme. The political emphasis is always somewhere buried in all of the Robichaud books, all 24 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have to be told about what those events are because they've faded away. And unfortunately, but anyway, that's how this became a borning.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, they've been friends such a long time. They go way, way back to childhood. And so many detectives are famously loners, but not these two. They never lose track. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what that does for you to have them be sometimes mirrors for each other in your writing.
Well, I haven't thought about it. I don't outline, and I really don't know what the characters in my books are going to do next. And I remember what Hemingway said, that if he knew the end of his story, then the reader would too. I've always tried to keep that in mind. But I never really have much organization. The first book that I wrote, Half of Paradise, was one that I used maybe sometimes a legal pad and outlined a few things about in a chapter, but that was the only time I ever put any kind of thought before I wrote. Maybe it shows, but...
No, I don't think we'd keep coming back if it showed that clearly. When do you remember inventing Cleet? What came to you first about him?
Well, that's a thought. Golly, the person who comes as close as I can think about Cleet was a fella I went to high school with. And since that time, if I talk about people, did you ever hear about a fella like Cleet at your school, and someone will say, "Hey, yeah, this guy," because there's always that one guy. This guy has this kamikaze brain who'll do anything, no matter what it is. If any dare, he will do it.
Yeah.
And he's the guy that gets even for the rest of us. And that's, of course, what the trickster, the medieval trickster, was, and during medieval times. And so that he actually is out of the 14th century. Most of my stories come out of the 14th century, and if they're not there, they're back in Grecian times, and times of Pericles and the Golden Age. And fortunately, I had a classical education. It's not accessible today.
Not really, not at all.
No, it's colleges or business schools, and they're, I'm afraid.
Well, tell us about Cleet's fascination with Joan of Arc, which comes through in this book. That's such a wonderful, wonderful image. You know, we have a Joan of Arc parade every January now.
Is that right?
Well, yeah.
Good for New Orleans. That's great. She appears here almost as a teenage girl.
Right.
And I hadn't thought about it that way, but it was my intention that we meet the girl who was innocent and was like all young women who think the world is a beautiful place, except so much was taken from her. It was just like all the forces of evil saw this beautiful woman, and they feared her, and they did the worst damages they could possibly impose on this poor girl. I mean, just golly, the bishop, Cochon, and the royal man, the royalty who may have raped her. It was the reason that she just gave up and decided to allow them to kill her. She could not deal with the cruelty that was imposed on her. I just think about it. And it's just, I talked to the lady who wrote this about 10 years ago, this beautiful biography of Joan of Arc, and I forget the title. Boy, what a book! But you never get it out of your head. You don't want to get it out of your head, but it makes you fear your fellow man. That how can people be this terrible? And then we start thinking about the fascist and the crematoriums in Europe and Hitler. And when you think about it, you think, my God, this is not just simply an aberration. It's there. You just can't deny it.
But Joan is a perfect figure for this book and perfect for Cleet to be visited by, because he has these romantic, worshipful ideas about women and their strengths.
That's it. That he has an enormous sympathy for the problems of women, and the problems that of women have been forced upon them. We males, we think up things and raison d'etre for looking down upon them, but it's because of male fear. This is something I believe, and it's not a metaphor, that God's perfect creation is womanhood. It is this is the perfect creation. And when it comes to comparing people, it's just not a horse race, that they are superior to men in every way. If we had left early mankind, and we always say mankind, if we had left mankind have its way, we would have become a dead evolution.
Well, I thank you on behalf of all women, Jim.
Well, but think about it. I mean, all anthropologists know this, that 80% of the food was gathered by women and children. And the hunters only supplied about 20%.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Lee Burke, whose new novel is Cleat. You've recently received a great honor in New Iberia. And there's now a statue of you on Main Street in the downtown area.
That says it's a bronze statue. And it's a big one. It cost $100,000.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really honored and proud, yeah.
And it's by a wonderful sculptress from Houston named Shirley Scarpetta. So what did you think when you saw it? Did you send her pictures or did you... What does it feel like to rule over Main Street in New Iberia?
Well, I just hope when the robins come, you know, there are hundreds of thousands, they fly down from the north and they all land in New Iberia. I hope the robins take care of my statue.
Post a guard.
But it's in a beautiful spot. It's right there on the town square. The square used to be across from the old Frederick Hotel, which I've written about many times. It's not there anymore, the hotel. But it's a great place to be. That's the old Spanish Trail. It went from Miami, the Spaniards, through the Gulf States and all the way to New Mexico and finally to Los Angeles. You know, that Highway 90 goes that far. Yeah. So it's like sitting on... are standing on the side of 400 years of American history.
So
that's
much,
it about man. Louisiana. Golly, just it's everywhere. You put your hand on the past, you can't avoid it.
Right.
It's just like there's a heart thumping inside a live oak.
We've been talking with James Lee Burke, who brings Louisiana to life like nobody else. His new novel is Cleat. And if it's summertime in Louisiana, that means Dave Robichaux and Cleat Purcell are roaming the bayou. And you'll enjoy James Lee Burke's fine writing, every beautiful, shocking word. Jim, thank you so much for this.
Oh, well, thanks, Susan, so much. And it's a great honor to always be on your show.
Kent Wascom was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, raised in Pensacola, Florida, and his fiction exemplifies the weird and wonderful possibilities of both places. In his new novel, The Great State of West Florida, Kent continues his saga of the Woolsack family, rogues we've already met in three previous books, The New Inheritors, Secessia, and The Blood of Heaven. The Great State of Florida is a wild ride and the perfect summer read. Kent Wascom, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's great to be here.
Now, I especially loved reading that your daughter, Rosemary, suggested you write a novel about cowboys and a girl with a robot arm. And that's just what you did.
Well, you know, that's inspiration coming from a really special place, and exactly when I needed it. I had written a big, long, serious version of this same story with a lot of the same characters covering a lot of the same territory, but it didn't work. And I certainly wasn't in love to it, man. I was in that spot where I really needed something to bring me back to the page. And she and I were sitting on the carpet right here by my desk playing with MagnaTiles. And I think she picked up something in the air. Like, I think he's not doing too great. And she tossed me that. And it was perfect from then on.
I think she has a brilliant future as a literary agent or an editor. I think you
ought to. She's got great taste, I must say.
Lead her in that direction. So tell us about this branch of the Woolsack family and their attachment to West Florida and your attachment to West Florida.
Sure. Well, in this novel, we're following the orphaned, I guess, youngest of that family, or the branch of it. He is drawn into the world of West Florida, which he, like me for most of my life, had no clue about. I didn't understand what that meant, even though I grew up in Pensacola and, you know, was born in Louisiana, and my family's from the Florida parishes. I didn't know about it really as a, you know, essentially a state that had stretched from Baton Rouge across to Tallahassee until I was at LSU, looking for material, but also looking for a sense of self and identity. I had, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Florida, I was really vehemently from Louisiana. And you know, we went back every weekend to visit family, stuff like that. So I felt, you know, I felt really attached, but also was doing that kind of jerky teenager thing where, you know, you define yourself by what you aren't. But anyhow, then I went to LSU and was really quickly made aware that, you know, nah, son, you're from Florida. So, I mean, you know, I was up there in Middleton Library and looking through the Louisiana history section and found Stanley Crosby Arthur's pamphlet, The Story of the West Florida Rebellion. I said, what the heck is this? And pretty soon I flipped through that book and saw a map. And it was a map of basically everywhere I lived for my entire life with these new to me boundaries. I've wanted to write about other things, but I always keep coming back to that idea and to this family who, yeah, I've been following for quite a while at this stage. But, you know, the way I think about this book is that it is the, like, mass market paperback that the characters in my historical novels would read. Like, this is the wild and intense version, more intense than normal maybe, version of events, but especially like processed through the genre of the Western and cyberpunk and all kinds of stuff.
Well, that neon pink and orange cover does it all, you know.
I'm eternally grateful to Jeff Miller,
yes,
the cover designer. Just an absolutely magnificent job.
Now, you never get tired of these folks. They're so interesting, and they surprise you at every turn.
They do. They certainly surprise me. And sometimes they can surprise family members as well. I lean close to my experience in a lot of ways in this book. I didn't have the net of like history to work with for the first time. And that was like a little freaky. But then also I kind of, you know, figured like if I've been putting, you know, some of my ancestors sort of, but definitely a fair amount of other people's ancestors through the paces in my historical novels, then, you know, turnabout's fair play with some of my cats.
Well, the thing about it is every now and then you read a book and it's so outrageous and it's so much fun. And you can tell the author was just having the time of his life writing it. That's how this felt to me reading it. What was it like in the writing?
Thank you so much. Let me tell you, the first version.
Maybe not that one.
Not so fun. That 4 or 5 years, but it also felt really, I mean, I was writing a grim book and in a grim tone about grim stuff, right? But yeah, once that switch got flipped and Rosemary tipped me that inspiration, I really quickly also like kind of tried to channel some of the negative things about writing the previous version, which was like, you know, you start looking over your shoulder and kind of seeing AI back there looming, like, okay, I don't know about the future of this whole thing. Oh, it's been a few years since I've done a book, all that kind of stuff. It's like, okay, well, fine. If, you know, maybe there won't be another one. Maybe this is my last book. And if it is, then this is how I want to go down. Like, I want to put as much of myself in there as possible. And the things that I like, the things that bring me back to the page, but also just like straight up trying to do what the chefs say, and you know, it's me on a plate. So, yeah.
Serve it up. So tell us about Destiny Woolsack, also known as the Governor. She is a fair rival to Quentin Tarantino's Pride in Kill Bill, I gotta tell you.
So thank you. That is as high of a compliment. I think as my character can get, especially as somebody who, you know, that's a really important movie. And say where I was, when I was when I saw it in Pensacola in high school.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was everything. And, you know, that kind of idea, too, of bringing a bunch of genres together in a work of fiction that's also telling like a really personal story. That's certainly a major inspiration. But anyhow, Destiny is someone who starts this book out in danger, in extreme danger, and in just a bad position in life in general. She's wanting to leave her wild and messed up family behind, right? But unfortunately, their house comes under attack by a group of people who are bent on avenging a past wrong. Because said my wolf acts are not a good bunch. But anyhow, she comes out of that. Not to spoil too much of the prologue, but she comes out of that wholly and utterly changed. And by the time we meet her again, she's taken up the mantle of at least her idea of West Florida as a place, in opposition to these other people who her family and the Wolfsacks have also like overlapped with in the past, who like really messed them up. Years before, this crew called the Yarbroughs and Troy Yarbrough's right-wing politician married to a megachurch magnate, and together they are bent on turning West Florida into basically a white Christian ethno state. And you know, my characters are pretty bad, but they're not that bad. so they're gonna square off. But yeah, Destiny herself, by the time we meet her again, she is part human, part machine, part messiah, if I can say, and maybe the RoboCop sense, and all kinds of intent.
Now, of course, I have this great vision of this big dark box on your desk. This is big, grim version.
Yeah.
You know, of the first part of this book. So do you feel like redoing it in this way and writing this new version has given you, you know, a new string to your bow? Has it added something to your voice or made you change direction? Has it made you think about your next project differently?
Yeah, I mean, all of those things, for sure. No, it feels like a new leaf on life. Not that I was like feeling lousy before, but as somebody who's like, I am, if I look at my desk right now, there's, you know, Akutagawa Prize winners and Fiction and Translation and, you know, Dahlke Archive books, and there's mass market paperbacks.
Yeah.
And there's comics. And those have always been on the desk, but they haven't been acknowledged directly or embraced, like as a form and an idea. And I'm just so grateful that Grove embraced it as an idea to publish this book in the way that we have, and to embrace it in terms of design and presentation, in terms of tone and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, for me, like, I'm definitely coming back to this world. Like, I cannot shake it. I also probably just have like congenital novel sequence syndrome. Like, maybe there should be another one of the story. But there's unfinished business at the end of the book.
Yes.
So we have to resolve it. But yeah, I'm excited to move in that direction, and got another project cooking set in Slidell and Angola.
All right.
And other places.
But. Well, I will always remember this one as one of the books that made this summer. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Oh, Kent. We've been talking with Kent Wascom about his wild and woolly new book, The Great State of West Florida, the perfect beach book. Tuck it in your book bag and head off to the shore. Kent, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's happening in the literary life this week. Liz Williams and Maddie Hayes will sign the new Southern Food and Beverage Museum cookbook Saturday, June 22nd from 2 to 4 at the museum. There is an admission charge. Brooke Champagne reads from and signs Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy, Saturday, June 22nd at 5:30 at Blue Cypress Books, and again Sunday, June 23rd at the Liminal Reading Series at the Domino from 6 to 7. Bar Redux presents a reading for Pride Month, Monday, June 24th at 7, featuring Fernando Rivera, Brad Richard, Nayeli Barrios, Wanda Noonan, Kristen Reno, Daniel W.K. Lee, Danny Unger, Ben Fluitt, Evie Lee, R.J. Green, Les Patton, Megan Sullivan, and Genevieve Frames. The William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition has extended its deadline to June 30th for all 9 categories: novel, nonfiction book, novella, short story, novel in progress, essay, poetry collection, individual poem, or short story by a high school student. For more information and complete details, visit www.faulknersociety.org. Winners will be announced at the Society's Fall Festival, September 26th through 29th. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.